Appendix A. This appendix contains articles, essays, and notes that are referred to in the text. They were composed by the author during the writing of this book. The Gospel of Radicalism by Prester John. Just a few hundred years ago, it was a standard medical practice to bleed sick people, to make cuts in various parts of their bodies and drain blood from them. Most people submitted to this useless and frequently harmful treatment without question. Would you have been one of them? What do you think of the bleeders? Does it seem to you that they were from a primitive and ignorant age? Well, guess how your descendants are going to think about our generation in a few hundred years. Unless you can break with the clamor of popular opinions, you are doomed to that fate. All of the social, sexual, and political norms that people now hold dear will someday be gone, and will look as archaic as praying to the gods of the wind and rain. Rationalize anything you want, but most people are living in ways that will be pitied by future generations. The fashion of this world will pass away, and it will not be missed. Look at our history. 6,000 years of wars, famines, epidemics, and non-stop emotional misery. Dear God, isn't it time to question the rules we've been living under? At some point, shouldn't it become obvious? How much misery do you need before you start to ask hard questions? Shall I recite statistics of you of how many millions of people were violently killed in the past century? How many millions were starved to death by the authorities that ruled them? How many people, probably billions, were emotionally damaged to the point of reduced function? What will it take? Are you in so deep of a fog that you will never question whether something is fundamentally wrong? Humanity in our time remains in infancy. We are essentially unlimited creatures, yet we have been wallowing in abject poverty, physically, mentally, and spiritually. We have natures that are suited to high adventure, yet we remain stagnant. Why? Because we've been conditioned only to exist, not to live. That conditioning was imposed on us as weak children, then reinforced during many years of compulsory training. After a while, we learned not to buck the system, and eventually to find a safe place within the social order. We are afraid to venture too far out. The powers that be make sports of ruining people who venture too far out of bounds. So we stay safe and ignore ourselves in the process. Safety is a fine thing to choose when you are 5 years old, but not when you are grown. Your life is too valuable not to be lived. By virtue of being a healthy human, you have what seems to be unlimited potential. Why the urge to sit quietly? Why the fear of movement and expressiveness? Why the paralyzing fear of being different? Wake up. Don't be satisfied to merely exist. Live. The Allegory of the Swamp by Prester John. Swamps are smelly, uncomfortable, and full of dangers. But if you have lived in one all your life, it seems normal to you. Also, if you had never ventured beyond the borders of the swamp, you would have no idea that anything better existed. If you tried to imagine life outside of the swamp, you would have no mental images to draw upon. In my last essay, The Gospel of Radicalism, I hope to convince you that the world is massively screwed up, and that compliance with it will keep you screwed up. My favorite analogy is that of living in a swamp. The swamp stinks, and it is host to an abundance of dangerous animals. Yet it can be survivable. Not exactly a nice place to live, but not impossible to live in either. If I'm correct, almost all of the great social arguments of our time revolve around organizing life in the swamp for maximum survival. But there is a far simpler, more elegant answer. Leave the swamp. However, when such an idea is proposed, people always say, "Oh yeah, and go where?" They have no idea of what any other type of life would look like. And so, they sit back down in the swamp and try to stake out a bearable, uncomfortable spot. Sure, thousands and sometimes millions of people are butchered every year in wars, Certainly emotional damage is endemic, and yes, the world is desperately confused and unstable, but it is the world they know, and they do not believe another world could exist, so they sit. They may be miserable, but they will not move. There is only one way out of this mess, but it requires things that most people don't want to do. To think rigorously, and to try truly new things. You don't suppose that we could get out of this mess by using feelings, do you? 10 million Germans felt just fine about murdering all the Jews of Europe. Half a nation of Turks felt fine about murdering 1 million Armenian women and children. And you can fill in the blanks for 100 other slaughters. If the 20th century could teach us anything, it is that reliance upon feelings is the most dangerous of foundations. Now, to get out of this, we will have to fly in defiance of our feelings and think. The truth is that most people will do almost anything rather than this. How did we rise out of starvation? By hard thinking, experimenting, and allowing human energy, the energy of correct thought followed by action, to operate without constraint. The same thing applies to 100 other examples. Figure them out for yourself. Unless you can find answers that don't seem right, you'll never get out. If the correct answers seemed right to you, you'd already be out of the swamp. The only way to find such answers is getting down to objective facts and seeing where they logically lead. Right now, the swamp feels normal to you. You've noticed the smell, and you've seen the crocodiles and snakes kill people. You want the smell and the killing to stop, but you don't think anything exists beyond the borders of the swamp. You have no feeling for anything else, and you're afraid of the unknown. But if you ever want to get away from the smell and the killing, you'll have to leave the swamp. Smell and killing are the nature of the swamp. They will not change, no matter how many leaders and their new plans promise you otherwise. If you want to get to a better place, you'll have to leave the familiar place. I don't know if I can make it much simpler than that. There aren't any shortcuts. You'll have to put two and two together and do it doggedly if you want to escape the smell and the carnage. If you are not willing to pay the price, you'll remain sitting with the masses. It may be that you'll be able to avoid the killing. And if you are lucky, you may be able to avoid some of the emotional damage. Or maybe not. In any event, your children and grandchildren will end up in a stinking danger zone. Your choice. Prester John's Q&A number 1. Prester, you are founding your version of good and bad upon self-interest. How can you leave doing things for others entirely out of the picture? No selfless deeds? Sounds like hell to me. Seminary Steve. Well, first of all, using the phrase doing things for others creates confusion. Who you do something for doesn't make an action good or bad. It is what you do that makes it good or bad. Everything people do is for self-interest. That includes giving to charity and nursing the sick. You do it because you value the people you're helping. You think it is worthwhile to birth some kindness into the world. You are doing this because it makes you feel good. It may make other people feel good too, but you are doing it for yourself. Choosing not to use other people wrongly, to treat them well and to be benevolent, that is not selfless. That is an expression of integrity based upon your self-understanding of what being treated wrongly is like. Using selflessness as the definition of good is a scam. It is contrary to human nature. It is dishonest and it never works. And don't think that it comes from the Bible, because it does not. Loving your neighbor as yourself assumes that you first love yourself. This commandment is built entirely upon self-interest, and without self-interest, it has no meaning at all. Let me tell you something. I've done the selfless thing, and I mean that I have really done it. Not tried to do it as best I could. I did it full out with all my strength. And do you know what? It's a fraud. The people who have really lived altruistically are either in a deep guilt over their inability to enjoy it, or have realized that it is BS. It is a doctrine that contradicts human nature. It has never worked, and it never will, unless we someday become a race of hive-bound robots. If you don't believe me, go do it. Go live completely altruistically. Do everything for others, but really do it. No half-hearted attempts. You'll go give it everything you've got. Then you'll know the truth of the matter. Do you want to make the world a more beautiful place? Wonderful. Go do it. But don't ever think you're being selfless. You're being the opposite of selfless. When you are making the world better, you are upholding yourself. You are honoring your own love of beauty, life, and peace. You're working to bring your version of goodness into being. Be proud of what you are doing. Don't degrade yourself to say that the only good you can do is when you get your evil self into some sort of coma. It's a lie. Take credit for the good you do. And unless you are doing it at someone else's expense, don't ever feel bad about doing good to yourself. PJ. Prester John's Q&A number 2. Prester, I suppose you'll think that I'm not willing to let go of the subject, and I suppose you're right. Again, you go back to self-reference to establish goodness. I can't argue with you about the scriptures that say love your neighbor as yourself. Yes, that is built on self-interest, though I've never had it pointed out to me before. But isn't man's nature flawed? All the evil we see every day should at least tell us that. And if human nature is flawed, doesn't it follow that it is not a reliable guide, and that the definition of goodness must come from somewhere outside of flawed men? I know I sound like I'm challenging you here, but that's not my only point. I really think I'm correct. Seminary Steve. Steve, please don't ever think that I'd like you to disregard your own judgment. You are to be commended for sticking with it until you are convinced otherwise. As I see it, you're making a couple of assumptions that I do not. First, I do not think that man's nature is necessarily flawed. Most man's actions are obviously flawed, but not necessarily their natures. Next, even if man's nature were flawed, that does not mean that he could not use other tools to ascertain the true and the good. In fact, that is exactly what science does. By careful observation, reason, and verification, we can discover truths that we were initially blind to, or even opposed to. Steve, I know you're a seminary student, so I want to give you a couple of things to think about. When man was in the Garden of Eden, there is only one thing ever mentioned about their thinking, and that they were not ashamed. So the only thing we know about the inner life of someone living in paradise is that they are not ashamed. Interesting, no? There is obviously a great deal to be said about the Bible's story of the fall of men. But Adam and Eve's big mistake comes before they eat the fruit. They erred when they judged their own natures to be insufficient. The serpent says that if they eat the fruit, they will be as gods. But God had made them in his own image and had said that everything he made was very good. Were they fully developed? No. But they could have grown and matured into being as gods. They were, by nature, suited to such growth, and they didn't need the fruit of the tree in order to get it. Remember now the line in Philippians, where Paul says that Jesus did not think it robbery to be equal with God. Adam and Eve decided that their natures were insufficient to be equal with God. They were wrong. Jesus, on the other hand, did believe that his nature was sufficient. Adam's mistake was to undervalue his nature. If this is correct, then it may well be that mistrusting and devaluing of one's own nature that causes the evils that we see around us every day. If our natures are not automatically bad, but if we nonetheless treat them as if they are bad, wouldn't that lead to a host of problems and mistakes? If a man did believe in the sufficiency of his own nature, what would he be like? What would it feel like to be completely unashamed? Prester John. Reality is difficult, by Prester John. Yes, reality is difficult. Life is sloppy, unsettled, complex, and frequently more than people are capable of handling. That's the sad truth. Reaching some sort of comfort level with the situation is difficult, but important. Someone once said, "Any clear way, though it lead to death, is better than the tangle of uncertainty." I can understand this feeling, and I expect that many of you can also. Sometimes a clear choice would be the greatest blessing in the world. Notice that deeply religious people will even pray for the time of the end, knowing that they would likely be killed during that time. Their reasons is that during these expected times, good and evil will be clearly distinguishable. Good will be obvious, and evil will be obvious. Many of us would gladly face death, so to know for sure that we were doing purely what is good. Real life doesn't give this to us often. Almost all humans are uncomfortable with unsettled ideas and work to clear their minds of contradictions. We generally try to put every major concept into a category and to keep it there. The promise of simplicity is appealing, but it is false. The world is not simple and will not be simple anytime soon. Trying to see it that way requires errors of logic and purposefully ignoring or devaluing many things. Simple explanations, especially of problems, have frequently led to scapegoating and sometimes to genocide. Life is complicated and uncertain. The people who were nice yesterday might be harmful tomorrow. I am sorry, but that is the truth. The world we live in is a confusing and difficult place. Sometimes it will be difficult for you to handle, and you'll fail. Again, I'm sorry, but this befalls us all. From time to time, we all need a little help. Pretending that things are simple won't help, and no one is going to ride in and save you from uncertainty. Anyone seeming to is a liar, and probably a would-be dictator. I wish I could give you a fast, easy fix for this situation, but I can't. Get used to it and deal with it as best you can. Pick friends who strengthen you and who will help you in a low moment. Be thankful if you have a family that cares for you. It's hard for all of us. Maybe someday we can learn to handle this better, but for now there is no magic fix. It's just hard sometimes. I'm sorry. Covetousness and Revaluing the Self by Prester John. During my years as a rabid follower of Jesus, I spent a lot of time going over Bible texts, and I do mean a lot of time. Even though I no longer think that those texts were inspired by an omnipotent creator, I do realize that they were written by a lot of very insightful guys who, if not always finding the right answers, were at least asking the right questions. One of the things I discovered in my studies was the real meaning and significance of covetousness. Covetousness is one of those old words that was little understood even in the old days. Most people think it meant something like envy, but that falls significantly short of the real meaning. Covetousness has to do with something deeper, with valuing ourselves. Do you think that you have the ability to create what you want out of life? Now, I'm not asking you if you have actually done this. We all know that the world is fraught with traps, difficulties, and sometimes insurmountable obstacles. But if those obstacles didn't exist, would you have the built-in activity to create what you want? Let me provide some background on this by giving you a very literal translation of a passage from the Bible, Ephesians, that seemed to refer to what happened after the famed episode in the Garden of Eden, beginning just after man was ejected. They went plodding through life in the ineffectiveness of their consciousness. The stream of their consciousness was dimmed by the solidification and desensitizing of their core. And so, they became non-participants in the divine life. This hurt them so badly that they became apathetic, and in that state, gave up control of themselves and toiled in the reverse catharsis with covetousness. The exact rendering of the word covetousness here would be more hold. That is, they sought to hold more than they had created on their own. By wanting to hold on to more than you've made, you are judging yourself as incapable of making it yourself. People who conceive of themselves as worthy of good things, valuable of themselves, deserving and expectant of pleasure, are not covetous. Since covetousness presupposes that you cannot get what you want by your own virtues and must seize it by fraud. Thus, when you sell out, reach a point where the money is good enough for you to sell your honor, you are naming your own values. This finds application in myriad ways. The point of this discussion is that all humans of our era must fight to revalue themselves. All of us have been touched by covetousness in one way or another, probably in many ways, and have accepted the devalued self-estimation. There is another very interesting Bible passage that literally translated says, "According to your estimation, it happens unto you." No, having devalued yourself is not your fault. We were all born into this. These ideas have pervaded all generations and groups of men throughout recorded history. We learned it from our parents and associates, who learned it from theirs. But though it is not your fault, it remains your problem to fix. The solution is to revalue yourself. This does not mean that you should become arrogant and fake. It means that you should analyze your own self-image and refuse to act on a low or negative estimation of yourself. This will be a slow process and difficult at times. By virtue of being a living human, you have immense capabilities. Yes, there may be difficult or even impossible obstacles in front of you, but that does not change your basic abilities. They are there and are more powerful than we have understood. Remember that sacrificing truth and honor to what seems immediately necessary is based upon either a low esteem of yourself or, only occasionally, upon truly impossible obstacles. Work on it. It'll take time, but work on it. The Unity Ideal by Prester John. It seems that almost every political or religious philosophy holds to what I call the unity ideal. This is the idea that if we could all just be completely unified, every problem would wither away, all our needs would be met, untapped power would spring into action, or something along these lines. It is false. Certainly this is an old, old myth, and there are stories supporting it in most of the holy books and national myths. But it is not true. The unity ideal is a spiritualized dream of getting something for nothing. Unity is a false god, an idol. The unity ideal is infantile and needy. People who embrace it hope to cover their personal deficits without having to face those deficits, either by magic or at the expense of the collective. By embracing unity, the individual seeks an improved situation, either by virtue supplied by others, or by some special magic that will spring forth if we just submerge our individuality a little bit more. People who would never fall for such a scam in business are able to overlook the something-for-nothing aspect of unity because the transfer payments are obfuscated by the group's unfathomable size. Unity implies that everything can melt into one, so there is no reason to feel like your deficits are made up for by others. Your deficits are supplied by an unseen god once you all start to melt together. I am sorry, friends, but there is no unity magic. In fact, all evidence leads to the opposite conclusion. If anything approaching magic is to be found, it is in individuality. Where individuality has had the upper hand, prosperity, growth, and invention have defined the times. Where collective ideals, such as all melting into one, have had the upper hand, humanity was slowly sunk toward an animal level of existence. And I should add that a group of humans acting as one has never been maintained except by force and by terror. Consciousness seems to organize itself into the minimal suitable unit, or stated in reverse, into the maximum sustainable concentration. That's nothing but my observation, and I certainly don't have the time to prove it empirically. If that is at all true, then strong social grouping may alter the functioning of consciousness, diluting or devolving it, even if only temporarily. This might help to explain the madness of crowds. But regardless of my unproven personal hypothesis, It is clear that the more individual the unit, the greater the ability of its consciousness. So where does the unity ideal stand? Nowhere. It is a false god. It pumps your emotions, but it does not save. Mystery by Prester John. Humans have a predisposition toward pattern seeking. In most areas of life, this serves us well. But like all such things, it can be applied negatively as well as positively. Pattern finding, as applied to thinking, is called inductive logic. This is the process of beginning with specific information and extending it to a general conclusion. For example, we observe fish swimming in the ocean near our home. Then, at some distant location, we see fish in the ocean again. We then say, the entire ocean is the realm of fish. Inductive logic, mental pattern finding, while useful for hunches or hypotheses, is never acceptable as proof. I have known 3 drunks. All of them were Spaniards. Therefore, all drunks are Spaniards. Mystery is an excuse to believe in inductive logic, to accept it as proof. Mystery is all sort of mental shunt, a glitch in the programming, but people like it. They get an emotional boost from it, akin to the thrill of discovery. It is useful for bypassing or explaining unpleasant aspects of reality. By finding a plausible pattern, then referring to a mysterious or super-rational force as a catalyst. A fallacy of inductive logic can be used to save the individual from things he or she would rather not face. And please believe me, I am not trying to criticize people for making this error. There are few of us who do not share an inability to face certain things, and I think there are none of us who have not made such an error. No, I'm not trying to condemn. I am trying to point out an error that has caused great harm, an error that has been used against honest men and women for millennia, an error that we can eliminate, or at least minimize. Mystery provides an emotional boost that can be quite welcome in certain situations. When people do not actively live, as opposed to simply existing, or are not allowed to actively live, mystery is usually present, if only as a coping mechanism. If circumstances prevent you from ever experiencing the thrill of true discovery for yourself, mystery provides a similar emotional boost. Like a sort of morphine, mystery can soothe the mental agony of slavery. But also like morphine, it is a cruel drug. People addicted to it learn not to actually live. Various mysteries safeguarding them from responsibilities and from reality. As this mentality spreads, it displaces competing ways of thinking and living. This situation becomes critically destructive when one healthy person does somehow emerge in this mindset. The person who is capable of loving reality and loving life creates more contradiction than can be borne by the others. Then, for the comfort and sanity of the many, the healthy one must die. Prester John's Q&A number 3. You obviously believe in unregulated commerce, but doesn't that make it simple for robber barons and their monopolies to take over the world? Big corporations can do whatever they want, and we aren't strong enough to resist. Feeling anti-capitalist? Feeling. You're afraid of a ghost story. The truth is that the only way any monopoly has ever endured has been through state force. Go look it up and see. Free markets destroy monopolies quite well. The stories you've heard are half true and selectively chosen for their emotional impact. Now I'll let you in on a big secret. The real means of production is not money and machines, as Marx thought. It is people. People create the machines, and people operate the machines. People use the money. Money and machines are simply tools. It is the thinking man that is the real means of production. And ownership of this man is everywhere in the hands of a monopoly. In virtually every place on this planet, a monopoly of rulers owns the production of the people. They take their percentage of all production and make the rules of the producers' lives. And I should add, governments make possible these monopolies and sweetheart deals that you rightly despise. These are the real culprits, not the free market. So if my explanation is correct, Then it is governments that are the sole owners of the means of production, each with their own territorial monopoly. Most everything bad that Marx attributed to the owner of the means of production applies not to business owners, but to the rulers who enforce financial sovereignty over their territory. Thus, the true class warfare is not between men of varying degrees of wealth, but between the men who wish to control the lives and goods of others and the men who wish to merely be left alone and tend to their own lives. Prester John. P.S. For those of you who study such things, Marx's errant economic thought begins with a mistake in the labor theory of value. It is not mere labor that adds value to land or material. It is intelligently applied labor. It is not just the value of sweat, but the value of creativity and intelligence as well, the latter generally being the more important part. What is good? By Prester John. The defining of good and evil is of considerable importance, and few people have ever done it in a way that is understandable and which matches reality. Here it is in four easy steps. First, inanimate objects such as rocks, water, and air exist on their own. Second, living organisms must act in order to survive. Third, if a living organism ceases to act, and act correctly, it dies. The elements that contained the life remain, but the life itself ceases to exist. Fourth, therefore, the good for a living organism is that which furthers its survival and improvement. Life, whatever it is not just a matter contained in our bodies. If we die, the matter making up our bodies remains, but the life disappears. It is gone. The same thing happens to animals, the same to plants. If the organism does not act, it dies. So, to any living thing, the good is an action that preserves and enhances its life. Every action is known by its consequences. What causes benefit is good. What causes harm is bad. This is the principle of good and evil, and it need be no more complicated than that. Now, if you want rules of conduct, then it becomes difficult. The world is complex, and any given action may have many consequences, frequently both beneficial and harmful. Correctly defining a rule is almost impossible, since the situations in which it will be applied may be infinite. Is good a selfish concept? In the classical definition of the word, yes. Unfortunately, hack intellectuals have turned the word selfish into a synonym for destructively greedy. So for now, it's better to say self-interested. Yes, good is based upon self-interest. Always has been, always will be. Sure, there are 100 knee-jerk challenges to such a statement, but they all come up short. For instance, so I'll just shoot you and take your money. That'll be better for me. These are intellectually silly, although they seem emotionally potent to most of us. Will you be really better off with my $100, but with all my friends and every righteous man chasing after you? Not likely. If you project self-interest over a long period of time, you will find that it differs very little from traditional ideas of morality, such as the Ten Commandments. Analyze this for yourself and see if it is right. Now I'd like to go back to an important phrase I used in step number 3. Act correctly. Running around in a circle is certainly an action, but it would not be a correct action if your goal was to grow enough food to feed your children. Correct action produces the desired results. Anything else is incorrect action. So how do we humans find the correct actions? The actions that lead to our survival and growth? Animals are born with instincts that guide them in getting the food they need for survival. Humans are not. We are born with no protective furs or armors, with no claws, without ripping teeth. Animals are automatically equipped for survival upon this planet. We are not. Our bodies are functional, but they alone are grossly ill-prepared for survival. A naked, insane man in the wilderness dies quickly. Nature births animals into the world complete with all the tools and instincts of survival. Nature births humans into the world with minimal means of survival, save their minds. We must rise heroically above nature in order to survive. To do this, We must use our minds and use them correctly. Nothing else works. Correct Thinking by Prester John. You don't have to think if you don't want to. You can dial it down and just observe and react if you prefer. A lot of people do, you know. They watch what is going on and even react to it, usually by recalling slogans that they've stashed away in their brains. But they seldom analyze things. Instead, they simply follow the dominant opinions of their place and time. In some ways, it's easier, and you can do that if you'd like. Not that I recommend it. All sorts of unpleasant things can happen to you when your reasoning is turned off, but that is not my point right now. These essays will not be popular among authorities and rulers. I tell you now that many people will reject these ideas and ridicule them. But are they true? That you alone must decide. And you must decide by examining the ideas, comparing them to reality, and seeing if they hold up. These ideas will not fit in with most political, religious, or social mythologies. If those things are important to you, forget about my stuff. It will only cause you trouble. But are they true? Don't ask someone else to figure it out for you. There are no shortcuts in that work. If these ideas interest you, then you must find out if they are true. And you can only do that by testing the ideas yourself. Intimidation is your enemy, and serves only to shut down your mind. Don't take my word for it. Don't take anybody's word. Figure it out for yourself. How to know things. First, observe things. Second, form an explanation for what you observe. Third, test your explanation. How to develop new things. First, observe things. Second, arrive at an explanation of what you observed. Third, extend your explanation, extrapolate. Fourth, test your extrapolation. Short version of developing new things. First, begin with one or more things you know. Second, extrapolate. Third, test your extrapolations. No shortcuts are allowed. Hunches are fine for extrapolations, but may never be substituted for tests. The lessons of reality. First, the universe is comprehensible. If not, you couldn't tie your shoes, much less fly an airplane. No, we don't understand everything in the universe now, but given enough time, we might. Second, all humans pursue happiness. Third, happiness is subjective. Fourth, perception may vary, facts do not. Fifth, perceiving reality is better than avoiding it. Sixth, cause always precedes effect. Farber's first essay. It began with rogue traders and the merchants of Venice. They really didn't know what they were building or how it would work. They merely struggled for the betterment of themselves and their families. It began to break out when the deep superstition of the Middle Ages cracked open under the strain of new philosophies and religious ideas. It found room to thrive wherever new and wild vistas were found. It expanded with each discovery of far-off new lands. It made its home everywhere the old order was broken up and fresh starts were being made. It took a firm root in America and flourished there for 100 years. Never again, where history is recorded, will there be any question as to whether or not it works. It is the great discovery of the modern era, the positive sum game. It is the liberation of human energy to do its appropriate job. It is the operation of creation, using the only counter-entropic force we have, free human energy. You can see it work everywhere, from the research lab to the front office to the construction site. It is what drives the entrepreneur to develop and produce a new product or service. And it is what gives the construction worker pride when his skill overcomes a difficult problem, turning his blueprints into a functional structure. Why is the construction worker proud? And why does the entrepreneur exult? Because they have done the one thing that all humans have the impulse to do. To create something good that would not have been otherwise. Human energy is the great creative force in the world. Without it, things tend to entropy. As the second law of thermodynamics states, closed systems tend to entropy. Without active and creative human energy, everything goes back to an animal level of existence. This human energy does not function by obedience and compulsion. It cannot, no matter how many rulers wish it were otherwise. Look at the command economies of the dead socialist world. Within several decades, their occupants were reduced to an animal existence. Look at the millennia when constrained people lived at the pleasure of their kings, seeking permission from their rulers to live and work. They continually starved and died. Things began to change only when freelance merchants began living according to their own minds and breaking away from the permissions of their rulers. When human energy is free to move, creativity goes wild, as do motivation, happiness, and the accumulation of wealth. When it is restrained, the descent to animal existence takes over again. The discovery of this fact is what differentiates us from the Middle Ages, and not much else. Do you think the people who lived in those dark times were inherently less intelligent than we are? They were not. You and I are their direct descendants, not many generations removed. We're essentially the same. The term positive sum game signifies that this system creates more than the sum of its part. The only real magic, human energy, creates more than it started with. Take some raw materials that of themselves are of little worth, and when you add human creativity, you can create vehicles, computers, and spaceships. The materials themselves have been around since the creation of the Earth. If they could have turned into something great of themselves, they would have done it long ago. But they cannot. It is only when humans manipulate them according to their own ideas that they gain any real value. Thus, $5 worth of material becomes a product worth thousands of dollars. They who do not play the positive sum game instinctively fall back into being motivated by envy. Ultimately, they find reasons to feel that there are only so many pieces of the pie. This is the seed of destruction. The next thing they say is, if you have a bigger piece of the pie, then someone else has to have less. That is a zero-sum game. The idea that nothing is really created, just moved from one hand to another. Not only is it false, but it is also the credo of every envious looter who speaks of fairness and equal distribution of wealth, but who secretly hopes to get a share of the wealth held by others. The real controversy of our time is this. Is human energy allowed to work in the world, or will it be tied down? The miserable experiment of communism has taught the world's rulers that a positive sum game is necessary. So, their plan now is to allow human energy to work, but to siphon off as much wealth as possible without killing it altogether. We productive people are carrying the governments of the world upon our backs. Are they worth half of our efforts, half of our lives? They take half of our earnings away from us continuously by a vast web of taxes, fees, and regulations. For what benefit? To help the poor, they say, and glamorously infer that if you disagree, you are a heartless and dangerous person, and further that all will despise you. But if our money is forcibly taken from us, is it not the state robbing us? Any dictionary will tell you that this is so, but it is considered poor form to say so, even to consider it. And are the poor better off? Certainly some of our money goes to the poor, although most is eaten up in the bureaucracy. This feeds their bellies insufficiently, while at the same time locking them into a life of dependence that wages an unending war upon their souls. Is that a good thing? Are the poor better off for this robbing of producers and living in the state of dependency? Many of you will gasp and reel in shock that I would challenge the respectability and honor of your tradition, and you fear to let yourself consider my case. You have come up against someone who does not share your conspiracy of compliance. You must either turn away from these subjects or face the prospect of becoming a radical and of people saying bad things about you. Are you angry? If so, it is not because I am wrong. If that were the case, you would simply turn away. You're angry because I'm ill-mannered enough to bring up subjects that you wish to avoid. My ideas bother you. When they come up, you divert your mind to pat phrases like, "That is the price we pay for our society." You dodge reason and shunt your thoughts away in order to keep your mental comfort level. You do not face these ideas head-on because you are afraid of them. You are afraid that you might have to agree with them, and then you would have to face the choice either to be a hero or to be a coward. I stood one evening in IBM Plaza in Chicago, looking over the riverfront skyline as the sun sank in the southwest, and realized that the towering monuments to human effort in front of me were the result of the positive-sum game run at only half speed. Chicago was wild and open from the 1830s through the 1890s. Then, slowly, the curbs and limits were imposed by do-gooder government and collectivist types. These inevitably slowed the workings of a city that had been, as one writer said, geared for giants. But the restraints were not enough to stop the positive-sum game, only enough to slow it down. The Chicago skyline I watched was the result of the positive-sum game being played at half speed, yet its results were awesome. I thought about what might have been if it were allowed to operate unfettered. And then I thought of the greatest example of the positive-sum during my lifetime, Hong Kong. It went from rice fields to the greatest city of the East in one generation, an explosion of unrestrained human energy. What things we have been deprived of! What glorious accomplishments aborted and stillborn! And now our recent explosion of technology has become the target of bureaucrats worldwide. Where will we go from here? Will the positive-sum game once again be strangled, or will it migrate to new and open lands? But moving to a new land will be a problem, won't it? There is no land on this planet that is not claimed by some gang of rulers. So, until cheap spaceflight is achieved, there is only one new country to be found. Cyberspace. So escape there we shall, and there we will, and must, for our own sake and for the sake of our descendants, establish the positive-sum game without restriction. Toward that end, we have built a private free market. We used our own money to do it, and we've broken no laws that we are aware of, save laws that outlaw privacy. Now, the rulers are trying to stop us. Why? We want to run an experiment and see if freedom really is better than servitude. Why won't they let us try? Are they interested in the betterment of mankind? Or are they really interested in monopoly powers? All we want is to be left alone and to try freedom. Why is that threatening? And why do they wish to imprison us? James Farber. Farber's second essay. History books tell the stories of rulers. Some are kings, some emperors, some presidents or prime ministers, and some potentates of more exotic names. A few of them were more or less benevolent, and others were tyrants. Most were in between. But they all held one thing in common. They maintained a monopoly on the use of force in their territories. They maintained their right to use coercion and to prevent all others from doing so. Stripped of romantic rhetoric and patriotic emotion, the essence of rulership is the ability to maintain a monopoly of force. Argue if you like, but you will be arguing with the dictionary. Every reform of government and rulership to date has kept the central mechanism of coercion in place. Did some government reforms lead to improvements? Certainly. They made things considerably less bad, but they left centralized coercion in place. And for every good leader that came along, such as a Washington or a Churchill, we've had several times as many Stalins and Maos. I have friends who study such things, and they assure me that roughly 2% of all people are would-be dictators. If they had the opportunity to oppress the world, they would. Another 12% or so are would-be facilitators. That is, when one of the 2%ers comes to power, they are glad to fill a slot and vigorously exercise power over others. Like it or not, these people are out there, and they are drawn to the levers of power. And once every so often, they have their turns. When they do, Innocent people die in large numbers. Over 100 million died this way in the past century. Try to comprehend that. 100 times 1,000 times 1,000 people. Boys, girls, men, women, teenagers, short, tall, strong, weak, dark-skinned and light-skinned. All of them dead because twisted people were able to take hold of centralized force. If you have wondered why some of us are so determined to keep governments out of cyberspace, please understand that this is why. We've had enough of centralized force. We're removing the whole mechanism. We think it was a mistake from the beginning. We don't want there to be anything for the 2% to grab. If you want coercive rulership, keep it. We won't try to take it away from you. But we have chosen to opt out. Don't try to rein us back in. We won't try to make you live our way, and you don't try to make us live your way. We are not your property. Our arrangement has no central mechanism of coercion, and it has been working quite well for several years now. We like it. This new arrangement has, however, surprised us in several ways. One of the things we discovered was that once you remove the mechanism of coercion, you remove something else. Politics. Politics is the art and science of managing centralized coercion. This is the reason political debates are so infuriating. The final decision leads to unopposable force. Once the political process is completed, you have the choice either to obey or to be punished. Coercion is the sine qua non of politics, the thing without which politics would not be politics. Instead, if you remove coercion, politics becomes something else, economics. Things work by economic means here. If you don't like the way a market operates, just move to a different one. Or if no one does it the way you think is right, start your own. There are no protected services here, and nothing mandatory. You may opt out of anything you don't like, or of any services you like. We couldn't stop you if you wanted to start a communist collective. The only limitation would be that you could not force anyone to join or remain part of your collective. We have no mechanism for that. The entire system is built around the idea that persuading people to trade with you is moral, and that forcing them is not. We think our ideas are right, but we will not impose them on you. You can hold whatever ideas you like, just don't impose them on us. All this being said, what really concerns your rulers, and what is driving them to demonize us, is that people are leaving their systems and joining ours. Your children are joining the private digital economy in huge numbers. No, the young people are not joining us for historical or philosophical reasons. Those things are mostly for the older people. Young people are always looking for adventure and opportunity. In your regulated world, very few people ever get much real adventure or overwhelming success. They read about such things in novels and celebrity tabloids. They see them in movies. But very few of them will actually experience such things. Our world, on the other hand, has adventure and opportunity in wholesale quantities. Your children may have to work hard to get it, but a big life is waiting for them if they wish to earn it. In our realm, intelligence, daring, and perseverance are rewarded far more directly than in your regulated world. Here, you can be a complete unknown, with no connections and no wealth. But if you can learn to provide excellent ideas or services, you can get rich. No one here knows or cares about the color of your skin or your sex or who you sleep with or anything of that sort. If you can produce, you're a player. Want to go from rags to riches? Pick a valuable skill in our world. Throw yourself into it with all your might. Excel at it and start selling it. Time and effort are all you need. You don't need friends in the right places, only value to offer. And there's more. The truth is that the best rewards come to those who are first at something new. Jobs and Wozniak were the first to produce a good personal computer. But other people would have done the same thing within a year or two. They got to do all the cool stuff only because they were first. You can say the same thing for every other discovery or invention. Human knowledge is built piece upon piece, and new discoveries follow more or less in that sequence. If you want to do the really fun things, you have to get to the front of the line. The stream of human knowledge is now firmly rooted in our world. The frontier of Alvin Toffler's third wave is in cyberspace, and that's where the front of the line can be found. Now let me tell you about the future of the third wave. The central ideal of your old world is coercive authority. This is embodied not only in rulership, but in schools, in families, in religions, and in most every area of life. We were all born into a world that told us, do what you are told, or we'll hurt you. Our parents told us that. Our teachers imposed it on us. Our gods are envisioned this way. And certainly the rulers on the earth operate this way. From birth to death, continually, it confronts us all. Having lived with these ideas for 100 generations, humanity is used to this and can survive it moderately well. But it is far from ideal. From birth on, you are trained to sit, to obey, or else to worry that you might do something wrong without realizing. It puts you in a sort of perpetual cringe, unconsciously cowering in expectation of the next blow. Being used to it is no reason to think that it isn't damaging. We have eliminated this. It has no root here, no mechanism. This is having an effect on the world already, although it certainly has a long way to go. But it is here, and it is not fading away. It will be a generation or two before we begin to see how the coercion-free mind works, longer before it becomes dominant. Nonetheless, the seedlings have been planted, and they are thriving. We certainly didn't start this. Its roots trace back to every free thinker, to every rebel for truth, to the true heroes, who in 1,000 areas of life had the courage to be right, even in the face of opposition. We are simply carrying on their work at the moment when it threatens to reach critical mass. If we were simply one more reform movement, we would seek to conquer your system and run it our way. That, however, is not what we are. We do not accept coercion as moral. We do not wish to coerce anyone, and we will not submit to being coerced. We do not want to run your system. If all of this seems threatening to you, I'm sorry, I know how that can feel. We are not your enemies. We are your friends, and we are also your future. We will not harm you. We do not want to take your governments away from you. We do not want to control your governments. We are not asking you to change your lives. We are only withdrawing from your game. Go your own way, in peace. We wish you well. We still love you. We still care about you. And we'll spend time with you. And in the right situations, we would still defend you. But we will not remain part of your coercive systems. We are pleased to share this planet with you. But we do not wish to share your social structures. We want to do a new thing, a better thing. If you wish the best for your children, encourage them to step into the new world, a world where they can own their own lives and enjoy the fruits of their own labor. A perfect world? No. But a much better world than one with centralized coercion and obedience to authority as its main pillars. We do wish you well. James Farber.